Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to take a look at the coming of the European Monetary Union. Beginning in 1999, many of the major currencies in Europe, including the Deutsche Mark, are going to be dissolved into the euro. This is an enormous event from a political and economic standpoint, and I want to stress right from the beginning, I am the last person in the world who would be in a position to forecast exactly what is going to come from this. I'm not sure if there's anybody who could say past a point. This is, however, an enormous event, and we're going to reflect on some of the historical background to this event during this half-hour segment and indirectly during the next as well, in which we're going to reflect on the growing Nazi sentiment and demonstration within the ranks of the German army. That latter indulgence is going to be because of the fact that Germany is the dominant economy of Europe. It is the dominant political entity in Europe. It is one of the most important entities in the world. And the European Monetary Union, and by extension the euro, are going to be dominated by Germany. So the political nature of Germany is very much front and center in this particular context. Just how important the coming of the euro is, or the portent of this, the significance of this, was underscored in an op-ed column that appeared in the San Jose Mercury News on Friday, January 9th of 1998. This is a column by Ann Swardson, S-W-A-R-D-S-O-N, who is a correspondent in the Washington Post's Paris Bureau. This op-ed column is entitled, Euro Triumphs Over Coin and Country. And skipping down, we see a single sentence which underscores the importance of this event and the raison d'etre for this particular program. The last time this continent shared the same money was during the Roman Empire. Indeed, that was a long time ago, and that is one thing that underscores just how significant an event this is going to be. Another indication of how significant this event is going to be appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, December 14th of 1997. The following is an AP story datelined Luxembourg and headlined, EU opens doors to former enemies, subtitled, Once complete, the expanded EU will form a single market of nearly 500 million consumers stretching from the Atlantic to the Black Sea. And part of this article reads, The European Union flung open its doors Saturday to former enemies in Eastern Europe, but blocked the entry of its longtime NATO ally, Turkey. The EU leaders ended a two-day summit with invitations to Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Estonia, and Cyprus. They decided to hold parallel talks with Bulgaria, Lithuania, Latvia, Romania, and Slovakia on eventual inclusion later on. Now, said Polish Foreign Minister Bronislaw Geremek, quote, We can speak not simply about the enlargement, but the reunification of Europe. For a man of my generation, this is the real end of the Second World War, unquote, he said. Once complete, the expanded EU will form a single market of nearly 500 million consumers stretching from the Atlantic to the Black Sea without duties, quotas, or restrictions to the flow of trade. Well, indeed, I feel that not only does that article speak for itself in terms of the impact of this coming of the coming of the euro and the European Monetary Union, but indeed I believe that this dissolution of many of the world's major currencies into a single economic entity, and indeed the submergence eventually over the next 10 years or so of the European economies into a single economic entity dominated by Germany, does indeed constitute the end of the Second World War. And as I have indicated many times, it is my considered opinion that Germany won World War II, albeit over a course of some 50 years, and much of the victory having been achieved after the formal end of hostilities and achieved in the political and economic arenas rather than the military. However, I believe that the end results are very likely to be the same. By the way, if that seems utterly insane to some listeners, I would refer them to RFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, a massive archive show available from Spitfire, a tape duplication service that I hope to be able to tell you about, time permitting, later on in this segment. More about the coming of the euro and, indeed, the true significance of Mr. Geremek's statement, I think underscored in yet another op-ed column. This also from the San Jose Mercury News. This, however, from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, December 4th of 1997. This is a column by Thomas H. Naylor, N-A-Y-L-O-R. He is a professor emeritus of economics at Duke University and the co-author of Downsizing the USA. This column was originally written for the Baltimore Sun. And indeed, this column makes a very important point, which is that to a considerable extent, armed conflict on the battlefield is, to a certain extent at least, obsolete. I realize that's redundant. But because of the tremendous ferocity and destructive power of weaponry in the 21st century, it is altogether likely that international conflicts and power struggles will take place in the economic rather than the military arena, although the end results may be very much the same, and at least for the losers, perhaps just as destructive. Again, the Mercury of 12-497, a Thomas H. Naylor column. It's entitled, Money is Mightier Than the Sword, subtitled, appropriately enough, CEOs Will Be the Warlords of the 21st Century. And skipping down, describing the peaceful dissolution of the Warsaw Pact countries in 1989, 2 years later, the Soviet Union peacefully disintegrated. Czechoslovakia followed suit by dividing itself into the Czech and Slovak republics. On a recent trip to Prague, a former high-ranking Communist Party official said, quote, without firing a single shot, Germany has managed to achieve what Hitler never accomplished, the complete colonization of the Czech Republic, unquote. German investors might occupy parts of Poland that they lost in World War II. No force will be necessary. They will simply buy those parcels of Poland that they choose. What the column does not mention, of course, is that the dissolution of the former Yugoslavia was to a large extent the result of German pressure, and that it was very, very violent indeed, and to a large extent saw the restitution of the fascist forces in Croatia that had collaborated with the Third Reich and that to a large extent were simply put right back in power, albeit a half century later. In order to understand the coming of the European Monetary Union, I think it is important to take a look at it in an historical context. And indeed, in understanding German power politics over the last couple of hundred years, it's important to understand that one of the factors that has propelled Germany into the dominant position that it's in Europe, and that I suspect will be a dominant position in the world as a whole in the next century, is the fact that the Germans, for centuries, have seen quite correctly that economic control leads to political control, and pan-German theoreticians have long advocated economic control and economic conquest as a prelude to military conquest. And indeed, it would appear that the pan-German theoreticians' dreams are coming true with the European Monetary Union. It's important to understand that the European Monetary Union represents the concretization, the realization of a plan for German domination of not only Europe, but eventually the world, that was first formulated in the 1840s by a pan-German theoretician, economist, and propagandist named Friedrich von Liszt. His last name, capital V-O-N, capital L-I-S-T. Von Liszt's formula for a united Europe dominated by Germany as a vehicle for not only unhorsing Great Britain as the dominant colonial power in the world, remember that Liszt was talking in the 1840s, but ultimately as a vehicle for German domination. The von Liszt-ian formula for German world domination was described in a book entitled The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, subtitled Secret Germany Behind the Mask. This book was authored by an expert on pan-Germanism entitled, named Paul Winkler, last name W-I-N-K-L-E-R, and his book was published in hardcover by Charles Scribner's and Sons, copyright 1943. Now again, this book is entitled The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, authored by Paul Winkler, an expert on pan-Germanism, and Winkler began his book with a quote from Patrick Henry that was given at a speech at the Virginia Assembly in May of 1765, and Patrick Henry spoke saying, quote, I know of no way of judging the future but by the past, unquote. And indeed, I think that it is important to study the past in order to understand the present and accurately anticipate the future. Paul Winkler, in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, discussed Friedrich Liszt's formulas for, actually, not von Liszt, but Friedrich Liszt, capital L-I-S-T, Winkler describes Liszt's formula for German world domination in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy. Bear in mind that Friedrich Liszt wrote in the 1840s, and that this book was published in 1943, more than a half century ago. In a section of the book entitled Starvation as a Springboard, Winkler writes, Friedrich Liszt, along with several minor economists active around 1840, was responsible for formulating the principal theories on which present-day German economic conquest is based. After emigrating to Pennsylvania and becoming an American citizen, Liszt was concerned only with Germany's greatness. He returned to Germany in 1840 to publish there his principal work, in which he outlined the basis for his national system of political economy. Violently opposed to the principle of free trade because it gives the same advantages to weak as to strong nations, he would welcome its use without reservation within the continent of Europe once the continent were dominated by Berlin, and he had high hopes that this would be achieved as soon as possible. So far as his own age was concerned, however, he was an extreme protectionist and advocated development of new industry in Germany through high protective tariffs raised against competition of foreign countries. He took into full account the risk of losing Germany's foreign markets, since protectionism always provokes reprisals. His remedy is simple: stimulate tremendous expansion of Germany, including conquest of Europe, acquisition of colonies in Australia, New Zealand, India, and the Americas. Then, Germany would no longer have to fear that she might lack foreign markets in a protectionist world. According to Liszt, a nation must conquer all countries lying in its sphere of economic action, by degrees, but steadily. And this sphere of action is defined as every territory which may serve as outlet, or which contains raw materials the nation may need. In the long run, this becomes perpetual conquest, for virtually every foreign country, however distant, represents a potential export market, or is a producer of useful raw materials. In the ideas of Liszt, we find the economic basis for General von Bernhardi's thesis, that's capital Bernhardi. Quote, for us, there are two alternatives and no third, world dominion or ruin. And skipping down, more about Liszt's formulas for economic domination. Charles Andler, capital A-N-D-L-E-R, a French author, summed up certain ideas of Liszt in his work, The Origins of Pan-Germanism, published in 1915. It is necessary to organize continental Europe against England. Napoleon I, a great strategist, also knew the methods of economic hegemony. His continental system, which met with opposition even from countries which might have profited from such an arrangement, should be revived, but this time, not as an instrument of Napoleonic domination. The idea of uniting Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc and not France. One more time, because that is exactly what the European Monetary Union is. It is the realization of the ideas and the theories of Liszt. Quote, the idea of uniting Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc and not France, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, and not France, excuse me, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, willingly or by force will enter this customs federation. Austria is assumed to be won over at the outset. Even France, if she gets rid of her notions of military conquest, will not be excluded. The first steps the Confederation would take to assure unity of thought and action would be to establish a joint representative body, as well as to organize a common fleet. But of course, both the headquarters of the Federation and its parliamentary seat would be in Germany. Well, the European Commission is in fact just such a parliament. The European Parliament is more a ceremonial body. And I would note that the European Monetary Institute is going to be in Frankfurt. Continuing. At once, the sharing of common commercial advantages would begin. Liszt proposes something like a cooperative league of nations in which all profits would be distributed in proportion to investments. European vitality, intelligence, and order would put the Far East to good use. Oriental ports would become free cities, unquote, where European agents would deal with native authorities in the capacity of advisors duly accredited and diplomatically protected. Austria would extend its borders to the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. a German navy would be built up, Prussian colonies would be established in Australia and New Zealand, where England has firmly planted her flag but failed to exploit resources. How could England resist all the navies and the concentrated economic power of a united Central Europe? Since Germany possesses a greater stock of vital energy and superior economic ability to that of any other nation, by the way, this, of course, in the opinion of Liszt, one may guess which nation would be likely to benefit most from this association, an association which was to be based on the principle of equal privilege for all members, unquote. And by the way, I would note that not only is the coming European Monetary Union the realization of the theories proposed by Liszt, but the dominant power in the world now, of course, is not Great Britain, but is the United States. So I think from a practical geopolitical standpoint, one can replace England or Great Britain with the United States. It should be noted that as the Germans conquered the nations of Europe in World War II, their economic infrastructures were subordinated to those of Germany, which gave Germany a profound economic control over the rest of Europe even after the formal end of hostilities. That is one of the factors that has propelled Germany to the dominant position it is in Europe, and I suspect eventually the world as well. This was described by Paul Winkler as follows in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy. Now, bear in mind, of course, he was writing during the course of World War II, and he was writing in 1943. Winkler writes, "Until the present, this operation has succeeded much more completely in a country like France, where local authorities have accepted the idea of collaboration, than in countries occupied against the resistance of their governments. In France, capture of control of corporations through forced sale to Germans took place with a show of legality because French authorities and courts, under pressure from Vichy, countenanced these transactions. The Prusso-Teutonics know that military occupation of France cannot last forever. Besides, they have probably considered the possibility of a German defeat, which would bring about the fall of the Nazi regime. They must have said to themselves that even in that case, conquest of France would have yielded them the key advantages they had hoped to gain. They figured that it would be extremely difficult for the French to find the legal forms to get rid of German control over nearly the whole of their national economy. This control having thus been established within legal framework according to French law, the task of destroying it would be arduous and complicated. This would be true even for a government under no obligation to respect the agreements of Vichy. It would, of course, be more true for any French government recognizing Vichy laws and decrees. All of this entered into the preparation for what Hitler calls the new economic order. This new order is in its entirety the old Prussian scheme of Liszt, which 90 years before Hitler's reign provided the blueprint for the creation of European economic unity under domination of a Prussian Germany. One more time, this new order is in its entirety the old Prussian scheme of Liszt, which 90 years before Hitler's reign provided the blueprint for the creation of European economic unity under domination of a Prussian Germany. It also provided for subsequent expansion of this Prusso-Teutonic Europe through invasion of the markets of other continents and establishment of, quote, protectorates, unquote, throughout the world. This scheme had always been close to the hearts of the Prusso-Teutonic powers of Germany, and had been placed by Dr. Schacht and Dr. Funk in the foreground of the aims pursued by Hitler. By the way, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht was the first and most prominent of Hitler's finance ministers. Continuing, territorial conquest has a meaning subordinate to economic conquest, according to Liszt's formula. By the way, one of the tactics that Dietrich was also advocated by the pan-Germanists was the political and economic conquest of rival nations through the use of what the Nazis referred to as a fifth column. This basically is a group of allies to the power that would effect conquest and who are obviously, therefore, by definition, traitors to their own country. And the Germans utilized this economic fifth column tactic very effectively in bringing France to its knees. That is discussed at considerable length in a miscellaneous archive show, specifically the September 4th, 1994 installment of Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce, dealing with the 1938 coup attempt in France and the subversion of the French military and political infrastructures by domestic fascists in league with Germans prior to the Nazi invasion of and consequent lightning conquest of France. Paul Winkler wrote of the von Bülow tactic in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, and wrote as follows. Dietrich von Bülow, B-U-E-L-O-W, of whom we have already spoken, and who died in 1807, had this to say in his Spirit of Modern Warfare. And then skipping down, von Bülow also clearly formulated the ideas underlying the penetration, now a sad reality, by the fifth column into democratic countries, including creation of, quote, economic allies, unquote, in enemy countries, in the persons of a few great industrialists to whom economic advantages are promised. This system gave Germany excellent results in the conquest of France, and before America's entry into the war, she'd tried to employ similar methods in the United States as well. In the writings of von Bülow, are anticipated all the advantages which Germany's masters later gained in several countries by carrying on a campaign of corruption of the enemy at home. By the way, I would note that the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I have spoken about in so many archive shows, including the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program dating to May of 1980, was one of the central factors in helping to bring fascism to Germany in the first place. Indeed, 70% of the investment capital that went to build up Nazi Germany came from the United States and Great Britain, most of it from the United States. And as we looked at in an interview with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews, had Franklin Roosevelt lived, he was going to have many of the German industrialists and financiers who had backed Hitler and who were standing trial in Nuremberg name their American and British co-conspirators, and many of the most prominent names in American finance and industry would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg had Franklin Roosevelt lived. Because indeed, as I have noted in numerous archive shows, those American financiers and industrialists who were instrumental in bringing fascism to Germany and Italy, along with their Italian and German counterparts, those industrialists and financiers comprise many of the elite of American finance and industry. And their role in helping to, and their economic cooperation with the fascist powers of Europe was central not only for the successful prosecution of those countries' war aims, but indeed in the very bringing to power of fascism in Germany in the first place. That is a tall order for the uninitiated. I refer interested listeners to not only the aforementioned Uncle Sam and the Swastika, but the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, as well as the first two RFA programs, and also RFA number 10, in which I discussed the 1934 coup attempt in which many of those same industrialists and financiers tried to overthrow Roosevelt and replace him with a fascist dictator set up along the lines of Mussolini. As I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, it is impossible, perhaps past the point, to predict exactly what the results of the coming of the euro are going to be. People that I know who understand international currency machinations better than I do are afraid that the euro is very likely to be a weak currency, and that in combination with the financial turmoil in Asia, this could produce a capital flight to the dollar that would create an unnaturally strong dollar, which in turn would make American manufactured products prohibitive to purchases in other countries. This would choke off America's manufacturing economy and would devastate the United States economically. Bear in mind that in analyzing the Liestian method, Liest advocated that Europe be united into a single economic entity under German domination, which it now is, in order to unseat Great Britain as the dominant power in the world. Well, Great Britain is no longer the dominant power in the world. That is the United States. Otherwise, I suspect that the plan is right on track. And we could substitute almost in its entirety what Winkler was writing about in 1943 for what is going on today. By the way, I would also note that, as I've spoken about in other programs, although it's not archived and is not available from Spitfire, the remarkable and deadly Borman organization, the underground, the economic component of the what I refer to as the Underground Reich, has a profound influence here in the United States. And in assessing Dietrich von Bülow's tactics, I think the remarkable and altogether deadly Borman organization should be taken very seriously in that context. Not only is there a possibility of economic devastation of the United States if the euro should be a weak currency, but if that currency is kept strong by keeping European interest rates high, that is likely to result in either continued or exacerbated unemployment in Europe. That in turn could fuel the sentiment for fascism throughout much of Europe as people take out their hostilities at their economic privation upon minorities, immigrants, people of color, and so forth. Some of the variables involved in the coming of the euro were expressed in the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, January 5th of 1998. This is an article by Martin Walker, W-A-L-K-E-R, of The Guardian, Dateline, Brussels, headlined, "Delicate New Euro Currency Evolves." And skipping down, "The euro, the European Union's new currency, is far closer than most people think. After its holiday sleep, Brussels comes back to life this week when Sir Nigel Wicks, W-I-C-K-S, chairman of the EU's powerful monetary committee, will explain to the European Parliament why the era of the euro really starts in May. That's when the 11 members of the eurozone will be formally declared and will fix the exchange rates of their national currencies against the new single currency. From then on, the euro will need to establish an almost instant reputation as a stable and carefully run currency. The EU's financial experts are urging members of the European Parliament to back away from their plans for, quote, democratic control, unquote, of the euro before they scare the financial markets. But the euro remains a giant gamble over the future of the world's biggest trading bloc. It represents a triumph of political will by a handful of Europe's leaders, despite fierce resistance in many countries, including Germany. There are three hurdles the euro has to overcome before it is launched formally in January of 1999. The first is to establish itself as a strong currency in the eyes of the markets, which probably means keeping EU interest rates higher than they otherwise would or should be. Since higher rates mean more expensive borrowing, there will again be less new investment and fewer jobs in Europe this year, thanks to the euro. And as I've noted, that might very well lead to a promotion, to an exacerbation of the rise of fascism in many European countries, which are experiencing high unemployment. And again, I think the coming of the euro, the dissolution of the currencies of the top industrial powers of Europe into a single currency, and the submergence of those countries into a single economic entity dominated by Germany is something that is to be considered very carefully. It is the realization of the theories of least, perhaps lending an entire new level of meaning to the old expression, that government governs best that governs least. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.